Here we had no curfew or other barracks regulations. Once all the day's work was done, we were free to joke and drink for the whole night, if we wanted to. We spent about a week in this way, with quiet, uneventful days. Each fatigued party obliged us to flounder through a sea of increasingly sticky mud. We made three trips back to the front, each time it was unbelievably quiet. On horseback or in carts, we took supplies to our troops, whose laundry was spread out to dry on all the parapets. Across the Don, the Russians appeared to be similarly engaged. We spoke to a bearded soldier and asked him if everything was going well. He laughed. "The war must be over. Hitler and Stalin have made it up. I've never seen it so calm for so long. The Popovs do nothing but drink all day and sing all night. They have terrific nerve, too, walking around in the open air, right under our guns. Work saw three of them going to get water from the river, just like that. Didn't you, Work?" He turned to a sly-faced soldier who was washing his feet in a puddle. "Yes," Work said. "We just couldn't shoot them. For once, let's all stick our noses out without getting a bullet between the eyes." A feeling of joy and hope had begun to take hold. Could the war be over? It really might be, Hals said. "The fellows on the front are always the last to be told anything like that. If it's true, we'll know in a few days. You'll see, Sager. Maybe we'll all be going home soon. We'll have a terrific celebration. It's almost too good to be true." "Don't count your chickens before they're hatched," said one of the older men from the Royal Bane. His realism damped us down a little. As usual, we set off down the track, more accurately, canal of liquid mud which led to our camp. We stopped a moment to talk to Ernst, whose section was trying to restore the track to a usable condition. "If it goes on this way," he said, "we'll have to take to boats. Two trucks came through here, and the stones we broke our backs shoving into the mud completely disappeared. It must be nice down in the trenches." "They're in a mess," Hals said. "And their morale is really terrible, too. I wouldn't be at all surprised if they broke up their guns for kindling. Our fellows and the Popovs are having a real spree down there." "Well, let them make the most of it," Ernst said. "There's something funny going on. That radio truck over there is taking messages non-stop. And messengers all the time, too. The last one had to leave his scooter and wade in here to bring the commandant his message. Maybe it was congratulations for your showers," said Hals. "That would be fine by me, but I doubt it. When those fellows run around like that, everybody else will too, before you know it." "Defeatist?" Hals shouted as we left. When we got back to the camp, nothing seemed to have changed. We devoured the steaming mess the cook served up and prepared for another evening of larking. Then Laus blew the whistle for assembly. "Lord," I thought. "Nubuck was right. Here we go again." "I'm not going to say anything about the way you look," Laus said. "Just pack up. We could be moving out of here any time now. Got it?" "Fuck," someone said. It was too good to last. "You didn't think you could just sit here and fart, did you? There's a war on." Packing up meant that we had to be ready for inspection, with our uniforms in impeccable order, and all our straps and buckles polished and fastened in the prescribed manner. At least, that is what it had meant at Chemnitz and Bialystok. Here, of course, that kind of discipline was somewhat relaxed, but it all still depended on the humor of the inspecting officer, who could quibble at anything from the inside of a gun barrel to the state of our toes, and impose heavy details, or endless guard duty. I could still remember only too well the 4 hours of punishment handed out to me a few days after I had arrived at Chemnitz. The lieutenant had drawn a circle on the cement of the courtyard, which was fully exposed to the sun. Then I had to put on the punishment pack, a knapsack filled with sand, which weighed nearly 80 pounds. I weighed 130. After 2 hours, my helmet was burning hot from the sun, and by the end I needed all my willpower to keep my knees from buckling. I had nearly fainted several times. That is how I learned that a good soldier does not cross the barracks yard with his hands in his pockets. So we rushed to get our gear in order, and frantically polished our sodden leather boots. And before we've walked 10 yards, all this will be for nothing. It took us a good hour to make our kit more or less respectable. Then we had another 24 before our country holiday on the Don was transformed into a nightmare. The day after our sprucing up, I was put on guard duty and given the period from midnight until 2:30 a.m. I had summoned up all my patience, and was standing on the platform of empty munitions cases which had been put there so the sentry wouldn't sink into the mud. Beside the platform, a foxhole half filled with water was ready to receive the guard responsible for the stocks of gasoline in this case, myself. The night was mild. A rainy wind blew fat white clouds rapidly across the sky, occasionally revealing a large white moon. To my right, the outlines of our vehicles and the camp buildings stood out sharply. Ahead of me, the enormous dark, hilly horizon melted into the sky. As the crow flies, the Don lay about 5 miles from our first line of German reserves. Between us and the river, some thousands of men were sleeping in conditions of almost unimaginable squalor. The sound of engines came to us on the wind. Both sides used the dark for moving supplies and troops. Two of the sentries patrolling our perimeter came by, and we exchanged the usual formalities. One of the men told a joke. I was about to reply when the whole horizon, from north to south, was suddenly lit by a series of brilliant flashes. Then there was a second series of flickering intensity, and I thought I felt the earth shake, as the air filled with a sound like thunder. Lord, it's an attack! Shouted one of the men on patrol. I think it's them. We could already hear whistles in the camp and voices shouting orders through the still distant noise of explosions. Groups of men went by on the run. Artillerymen who had been asleep were running to their guns on the edge of the abandoned airfield. As no one had told me to leave my post, I stayed where I was, wondering what would be asked of my comrades. A supply expedition through such a heavy bombardment would be an operation of an entirely different kind from the ones we had recently grown used to. The bursts of distant fire continued, mixed with the sound of our guns. Flashes of light, closer and more brilliant than before, turned the groups of men running through pools of water into shadow puppets. It was as if a giant, in a fit of terrible fury, were shaking the universe, reducing each man to a ludicrous fragment which the colossus of war could trample without even noticing. Despite the relative distance of danger, I bent double, ready to plunge into my water-filled hole at a moment's notice. Two big crawler tractors came toward me, with all their lights out. Their wheels and treads had churned the mud into a kind of liquid sludge. Two men jumped down, and almost disappeared in it. Give us a hand, guard, one of them called. They were splattered with mud right up to their helmets. The bombardment continued to inflame the earth and sky, as we loaded some drums of gasoline onto their machine. There's always something to fart in your face, one of them said to me. Good luck, I answered. Further off, the soldiers in my unit were rounding up the nervous, jostling horses, which kept falling in the mud and whinnying frantically. Several times, trucks came to collect drums of gasoline, so that by daybreak, when my relief hadn't appeared, I wondered how much there was left for me to guard. The bombardment was almost as strong as ever. I felt exhausted and confused. A group of boys from my company came by, led by a sergeant who waved me over to join them. At that moment precisely, one of the first Soviet long-range shells landed about 100 yards behind us. The explosion shook us, and we all started to run as hard as we could. I didn't ask any questions, but looked in vain for the broad shoulders of Hals. Other projectiles were now falling on the camp, which was lit up everywhere. We had thrown ourselves onto the ground, and stood up again covered with mud. Don't dive like that, said the sergeant. You're always late. Keep your eye on me, and do what I do. A significant howl filled our ears, and all 12 of us, the sergeant included, plunged into the liquid mess. an enormous explosion sucked all the air from our lungs, and a simultaneous wave of mud washed over us. We stood up again, soaked with filth, and wearing the pinched smiles of civilians who climb unscathed from a bad wreck. Three or four more bursts quite nearby forced us down again. Behind us, something was burning. As soon as we could, we ran to the nearest munitions dump. The sight of this mountain of canvas-covered boxes made our stomachs turn over. If anything hit it, no one within 100 yards would have a chance. "Good God," said the sergeant. "There's nobody here. It's incredible." With no apparent thought of danger, he climbed onto the hill of dynamite, and began to check the numbers on the boxes, which indicated their next destination. We stood and watched him, petrified, like condemned prisoners, with our feet apart, and our heads empty, waiting for orders. Two fellows soaked through, like us, came running up. The sergeant began to shout at them from his eminence. They snapped to attention despite the thunder of the guns. "Are you supposed to be on duty here?"
"Yes, Herr Sergeant," they answered in unison.
"Then where were you?" "The call of nature," one of them said. "You went off to crap like that, both of you at once. Idiots. We've got too much trouble here for fun and games. Your names and units." The sergeant had not climbed down. Silently, I cursed this animal with his niggling discipline, who stood there preparing a report, as if nothing unusual were happening. Fresh explosions which sounded very close threw us all onto the ground except the sergeant, who continued to provoke Providence. "They're cleaning up our ear," he said. "They must have let loose their goddamned infantry. Get your fat tails up here and help me." Half paralyzed by fear, we climbed onto the volcano. The flashes of light all around us lit our bodies in a tragic glare. A few moments later, we were running as hard as we could, oblivious of the weight of the cases, in our anxiety to get away. Daylight had now begun to rob the spectacle of some of its brilliance. The flashes of light were scarcely visible, and the horizon was shrouded by a dense cloud of smoke, irregularly punctuated by darker plumes. Toward noon, our artillery began to fire. We were still running from job to job, although we were nearly dropping with exhaustion. I can remember sitting in a huge crater which had been dried out by an explosion, staring at the long barrel of a 155 spitting fire with rhythmic regularity. I had found Hals and Lenson, and we were sitting together, with our hands over our ears. Hals was smiling, and nodding at each explosion. For 2 days we had practically no sleep. The dance of death continued. We were carrying the growing number of wounded to shelters half filled with water, and laying them on hastily improvised stretchers made of branches. The orderlies administered first aid. Soon these rough infirmaries, filled with the groans of the wounded, were overflowing, and we had to put fresh casualties outside, on the mud. The surgeons operated on the dying men then and there. I saw horrifying things at these collection points, vaguely human trunks which seemed to be made of blood and mud. On the morning of the third day, the battle intensified. We were all grey with fatigue. The shelling went on until dusk, and then, inside of an hour, stopped. Clouds of smoke were rising all along the battered front. We felt as if we could smell the presence of death, and by this I don't mean the process of decomposition, but the smell that emanates from death when its proportions have reached a certain magnitude. Anyone who has been on a battlefield will know what I mean. Two of the 8 huts that made up our camp had been reduced to ashes. The ones that remained standing were overflowing with wounded. Laus, who had a good heart when the chips were down, saw that we were foundering, and allowed us each an hour or two of sleep, as he could. We dropped to the ground wherever we were, as if felled by sleep. When our time was up, and we were shaken awake, we felt as though we'd only been asleep for a few minutes. With exhaustion threatening to overwhelm us again, we returned to the nightmare of carrying agonized, mutilated men, or laying out rows of horribly burned bodies, which we had to search for their identity tags. These were then sent to the families of the deceased with the citation "Fallen like a hero on the field of honor for Germany and for the Führer." Despite the thousands of dead and wounded,
The last battle fought by the German army on the Don was celebrated the day after the shooting stopped. The mouths of dying men were pried open so that they could toast this Pyrrhic victory with vodka. On a front approximately 40 miles long, General Zhukov, with the help of the accursed Siberian army, which had just contributed to the German defeat at Stalingrad, had been trying to break the Don line south of Voronezh. Instead, the furious Russian assaults had broken against our solidly held lines. Thousands of Soviet soldiers had paid with their lives for this abortive effort, which had also cost us very dear. Three quarters of my company left that evening. The trucks were jammed with wounded, who were lying almost in piles. I was separated from Hals and Lenzen for the moment, a separation I never liked. Friendships counted for a great deal during the war, their value perhaps increased by the generalized hate, consolidating men on the same side in friendships which never would have broken through the barriers of ordinary peacetime life. I found myself alone with a couple of men who may have been more or less interesting, but with whom I never had the chance to talk. As soon as I could, I abandoned them for a truck seat on which I attempted to regain some of my strength. The assembly whistle rang in my ears very early the next morning. I opened my eyes. The truck cab had made an excellent bed, more or less the right size, and I felt at last as though I'd had some sleep. But exhaustion had stiffened my muscles, and despite my sleep, I had a terrible time pulling myself onto my feet. Lining up outside, I saw the same exhausted, disheveled look on almost every face. Even Laus wasn't feeling particularly energetic, he had slept with his equipment like all the rest of us. He told us that we were going to leave this area for a point farther west. As a preliminary, we should stand by to help the engineers load up, or destroy what we weren't taking with us. We filed past a big kettle from which we were served a hot liquid that made no pretense to being coffee, and went to join the engineers. We were sent out with donkeys, under orders to range widely, picking up all the ammunition we could find, so that it wouldn't fall into the hands of the enemy. The departure seemed to be general. Long lines of infantry caked with filth were marching away from this sea of mud, to the west. At first we thought we were being replaced, but this proved to be untrue. The entire way MACT along the western bank of the Don had been ordered to withdraw. We couldn't grasp the logic of following a heroic three-day resistance with retreat. Most of us were unaware that the Eastern Front had entirely changed since January. After the fall of Stalingrad, a strong Soviet push had reached the outskirts of Kharkov, recrossed the Donets, and moved on to Rostov, almost cutting the German retreat from the Caucasus. Troops there had been forced to return to the Crimea by way of the Sea of Azov, with heavy losses. Our periodical Ostfront and Panzer Wolfram reported that there had been heavy fighting at Kharkov, Kuban, and even Anapa. We never heard a frank admission of retreat, and as most soldiers had never studied Russian geography, we had very little idea of what was happening. Nevertheless, a glance at any map was enough to inform us that the west bank of the Don was the easternmost German line in Russian territory. Luckily for us, the High Command ordered our retreat before an encirclement from the north and south could cut us off from our bases at Belgorod and Kharkov. The Don was no longer one of our defenses, it had been crossed both in the north and in the south. The thought that we might have been trapped, like the defenders of Stalingrad, still makes my blood run cold. For 2 days, the Lancer infantry had been pulling out either on foot or loaded in trucks. Soon only a small section of the Panzergruppe was left at the nearly empty camp. The passage of vehicles and men had turned the Luftwaffe field into an extraordinary quagmire. Thousands of trucks, tanks, tractors, and men rolled and tramped for 2 days and two nights through terrain running with streams of mud. We were in the middle of this syrup, trying to reorganize the materiel we had to abandon. The engineers were working with us, preparing to dynamite the ammunition we had heaped against the huts, over the carcasses of 8 dismantled trucks. Toward noon, we organized a fireworks display which any municipality might have envied. Carts, sleighs, and buildings were all dynamited and burned. two heavy howitzers which the tractors hadn't been able to pull from the mire were loaded with shells of any caliber. Then we poured any explosive that came to hand into their tubes, and shut the breach as best we could. The howitzers were split in two by the explosions, scattering showers of lethal shrapnel. We felt exhilarated, filled with the spirit of destructive delight. In the evening, the Spandaus stopped a few Soviet patrols, who had undoubtedly come to see what was happening. During our last hour, we were under light artillery fire, which caused us a certain emotion. Then we left. After the period of light artillery fire, the troops covering the Panzergruppe signaled several enemy penetrations into our former positions. A hasty departure order was given. We were no longer organized to hold off the Russians for any length of time. I was carrying my belongings, looking for a vehicle, when Arfeld assigned me to a truck we had captured from the enemy which was now carrying our wounded. "Step on the gas," he shouted. "We're getting out." Every soldier in the Wehrmacht was supposed to know how to drive. I had been given some idea of how to handle military vehicles during my training in Poland, but on machines of a very different kind. However, as one never discussed orders, I jumped into the driver's seat of the Tatra. In front of me, the dashboard presented an array of dials whose needles uniformly pointed down, a few buttons, and a series of words in indecipherable characters. The engineers had just attached the heavy truck to the back of a Mark IV. We would be leaving instantly. It was essential that I get the wretched machine to start. I considered climbing out and confessing my incapacity, but repressed the idea on reflection that they might assign me to something more difficult, or even leave me behind, to get out on my own feet as best I could. If I couldn't move, I would be captured by the Bolsheviks, a thought which terrified me. I pawed frantically at the dashboard, and was blessed by a miracle. My desperate eye fell on Ernst, who was clearly looking for a lift. I felt saved. "Ernst," I shouted. "Over here. I've got room." My friend joyfully jumped aboard. "I was ready to hang on to the back of a tank," he said. "Thanks for the seat, Ernst," I asked in a voice of supplication. "Do you know how these damn things work? You're a fine fellow, sitting here when you don't know the first thing about it." I had no time to explain. The powerful engine of the tank to which we were attached was already roaring. Hurriedly, we pulled at the controls. From the turret, one of the tank men signaled to me to put the truck in gear at the same time as the tank, to reduce the jolt for the wounded. Nubuck pulled a lever under the dashboard, and we felt a responding throb from under the hood. I pressed down hard on the accelerator, and the engine made a series of loud bangs. Gently, the Feld shouted at me. I smiled, nodded, and let up on the pedal. The chain stretched taut, and we increased our speed. How fast were we going? I had no idea. I knew with certainty only that we were not in reverse. The heavy truck took off with a brusque jolt, producing a chorus of groans and curses behind me. Later on, in France, a pretentious bastard undertook to instruct me on a wretched Renault 4 CV, with all the airs of a commander of an ocean liner. I had to sit through a course of ludicrous demonstrations to receive a scrap of pink paper declaring me competent to drive an automobile. I didn't waste any time explaining that I had driven through Russia on a track which was more like a river than a road, fastened to a huge tank whose jolts were a constant threat to the front of my machine, which I felt certain would be wrenched off. He would never have believed me. By that time I belonged to the victorious Allies, who were all heroes, like every French soldier I met after the war. Only victors have stories to tell. We, the vanquished, were all cowards and weaklings by then, whose memories, fears, and enthusiasms should not be remembered. The first night of retreat was complicated by a fine rain, which required of Ernst and me the agility and balance of acrobats simply to keep our Tatra in the wake of the Mark IV. Without the tank, we would never have been able to escape from that swamp. The driver stepped on the accelerator in fits of irritation, dragging the Tatra, which threatened to disintegrate. The tank treads churned the ground into a heavy syrup, which the rain thinned into soup. The windshield became completely caked with mud, and Ernst waded through the liquid ground to scrape it away with his hands. The blacked-out headlight had been left with only a narrow strip uncovered. Within a few minutes this strip was sealed by mud, so that we had no light at all. I couldn't even see the back of the tank, although it was no more than 5 yards ahead of us. Our truck, more often than not at an oblique angle to the tank, was constantly being pulled back into line by the tightly stretched chain. Each time this happened, I wondered if we still had our front wheels. Behind us, the wounded had stopped moaning. Maybe they were all dead. What difference did it make? The convoy moved ahead, and daylight dawned on faces haggard with exhaustion. During the night, the convoy had spread out. It no longer seemed to matter whether we were ahead of schedule or behind. The driver of our Panzer suddenly turned off to the right, leaving the track, which had become impassable even for a tank, and drove straight up the scrub-covered bank, crushing the sodden birches under his treads. Our truck, whose wheels by this time were balls of mud, was pulled forward, while its engine rattled helplessly. Then everything came to a complete halt. This was the second stop since our departure. We had stopped once in the night to gas up. The poor bastards on the back of the tank jumped down among the broken branches. Their backsides had been burning all night on the hot metal over the engine, while the rest of their bodies froze in the cold rain. An exchange of shouted abuse, which was nearly a fight, broke out at once between a non-com in the engineers and the Panzerfuhrer. Everyone else took advantage of this opportunity to crap and eat. 1 hour's rest, shouted the non-com, who had taken on himself the leadership of the group. Make the most of it. Fuck you, shouted the Panzerfuhrer, who had no intention of being pushed around by some half-baked engineer. We'll leave when I've had enough sleep. We have to get to Belgrade this morning, the non-com said in a steely voice. He undoubtedly nourished dreams of being an officer. Then, putting his hand on the Mauser which hung at his side, he added, we'll leave when I give the order. I've got the highest rank here, and you'll obey me. Shoot me if you like, and drive the tank yourself. I haven't slept in 2 days, and you're going to leave me the hell alone. The other flushed crimson, but said nothing. Then he turned to us. You too. Instead of standing there asleep on your feet, get into the truck and help the wounded. They have their needs, too. That's it, added the tank driver, who was clearly looking for trouble. And, when they're finished, the Herr Sergeant will wipe their asses. You watch it, or I'll report you, snorted the sergeant. He was now white with rage. Inside the truck, the wounded had not died, despite the jolting of the journey. They were no longer making any noise, and we could see that some of their bandages were soaked with fresh blood. Fighting the exhaustion which made our hearts race, we helped them down and back as best we could, omitting only one man, who was missing both legs. They all asked us for something to drink, and in our ignorance we gave them as much water or brandy as they wanted. We certainly shouldn't have done this. 2 men died a short time later. We buried them in the mud, with sticks and their helmets to mark their graves. Then Ernst and I curled up in the cab, to try to snatch a little sleep. But sleep wouldn't come, and we lay instead, with throbbing temples, talking of peace. 2 hours later, it was the tank driver who gave the order to depart, as he had predicted. It was now mid-morning. The day was clear and bright, and large chunks of snow fell slowly from the trees. Ha! He said. Our general left us all while we were asleep. Maybe he felt like taking a walk. It seemed that the non-com really was gone. He must have managed a ride in one of the trucks that had passed us during our rest. That shit has gone to make his report, shouted the tank driver. If I catch up with him, I'll drive right over him, flatten him out like a goddamned Bolshevik. It took us a while to extricate ourselves from the bank we had driven into. However, 2 hours later we arrived at a hamlet whose name I no longer remember, some 5 miles from Belgrade. It was filled with soldiers from every branch of the army. The few streets were perfectly straight, and lined with low houses. The way the roofs sat on the walls reminded me of heads with no foreheads, whose hair grows right into the eyebrows. There were swarms of soldiers, and a multitude of rolling equipment covered with mud, pushing through the shouting mob of soldiers, most of whom were looking for their regiments.